Welcome to Beyond Reality. I'm your host, Shelley Kerr, and today I am thrilled to be welcoming Fred Alan Wolf. Dr. Wolf is the author of many, many books, including Taking the Quantum Leap, Parallel Universes, The Dreaming Universe, and the new one we're going to talk about today, which I really love, The Yoga of Time Travel, How the Mind Can Defeat Time. You know Dr. Wolf from his starring role in the movie What the Bleep Do We Know? And our guest today, I met him last year when I was out in New York, and I walked by and I went, oh, it's Fred Alan Wolf! And so I probably acted like a silly celebrity starstruck fan, but he was very, very gracious. Dr. Wolf, welcome.
Well, thank you, Shelley. Nice to be back.
Beyond Reality. So I have to ask you, I mean, what is it like after being in the scientific community for so many years to have people come up and just go, it's him, the movie star? I mean, how does that feel?
Well, believe it or not, it doesn't happen that often. I mean,
oh, it doesn't?
So that's the first thing. I mean, it'd be nice to say, yes, it does, but it really doesn't. So it's not like it's a huge thing that happens to me all the time. I wish I could say it does, but that's not really the case. So pretty much my life is pretty normal. I do the things that normal people do, and that's just fine with me.
Well, that's good. I had got a friend of mine introduced me to your book on parallel universes several years ago, and I just thought it was one of the most eye-opening books I'd ever read on the subject.
Thank you very much. It's really, really good.
And I wanted to know, first up, I mean, how did you first decide to get into science? I mean, was it something that you'd been interested in since you were a child, or how did it come about?
Well, I've always been kind of curious about things, and I've always had a kind of an interest in the, you know, I guess you might say, the mystical, the mysterious things that were normally beyond our normal so-called consciousness. Those things always intrigued me. So I think it was the combination of those things that got me interested. I became interested because I basically like magic.
And physics is magic. That's
it is really a lot of magic. And the more you get into it, the more you begin to see some of the, you might call it, the deeper secrets that emerge. And they're really quite fascinating.
Did you have some early teachers that helped you? Because now you're probably, in my mind, you're one of the greatest teachers in this field.
Well, thank you. I don't know if that's the case.
Well, to me, I mean, I'm like one of your biggest fans. But
well, I appreciate that.
I really am. But did you have teachers growing up that helped you to understand it? And
well, I really didn't get into physics until my college days. I think my first few courses were at the undergraduate level when I was at the University of Illinois. But the real interest that got started in me was in my 20s when I started attending graduate school at UCLA and began learning some of the, you might say, the deeper secrets of how the universe works. And these were a chance to probe and explore the minds of some of the greatest thinkers about theoretical physics that have ever existed. And that's one of the joys that you get. That's one of the things that graduate school in physics is very, very promising. It's a lot of fun because you get to explore things that are normally beyond the ken of the average person that goes to school. Undergraduate school is very interesting, but graduate school, in some bizarre way, is actually easier than undergraduate school because it's more into the more specialized topics. And the thing is, the more specialized you get, once you understand the language, the easier it gets. So I think that's where my interest really got stimulated. It was in graduate school. I always had an interest in the bizarre aspect of science, or I'd say of life. And when I saw that science, particularly quantum physics, had so many bizarre things that it was predicting, I got extremely curious and more interested.
I just got back from a month in India, and in your book, The Yoga of Time Travel, you told a story about from the Gita about Krishna and Aruna, and I was wondering if you could relay that to us again briefly and talk about why that is important to the discussion of time travel. and parallel universes.
The story about Krishna and Arjuna, is that the one you're referring to from the Bhagavad Gita?
Yes.
Well, let me preface what's the word? Preface? I don't know if that's a great word. As a preface
that's a
to
word.
let me say something about what is at issue here. At issue is a person and the person's view of the world and the person's view of himself in that world. And these views, the person, his views, the way he sees the world, are all what are called conditioned by the mind. The mind is the great conditioner. And what we're dealing with in this story, in the Gita in general, is the relief of that conditioning so that events that were normally not considered to be part of the conditioning become revealed. And as a result of that revelation, the person is able to move on or transform or change and have an experience that he would not normally have been able to have. And in this case, it's the story has to do with the story of a king who has certainly a view of himself and the world and his responsibilities, and his how that view is radically changed, and as a result, his ability to function in the world is radically changed. So I can tell the actual story, but I just want to give you sort of a ground idea as to what's at stake here. And when we get to modern times, to the world that we live in today, a similar circumstance seems to be occupying us all. We all have great concerns about how we're going to survive, whether we're going to survive. There are current predictions that indicate that maybe the world's going to come to an end. I mean, we've had, you know, this kind of constant battle that we're constantly fighting between what we have to do to survive. Is survival so important that we have to kill in order to survive, or is it so important that we have to rob, cheat, and steal in order to survive? So these are the kind of questions that constantly come up. And associated with that question is a presence, a sense of self, which each individual has. And over the thousands of years of being human beings, that sense of self, although it may appear at times to have changed, it seems that it's an ongoing battle for us to overcome anything more than the survival sense of self, which basically has as its background that you were born, it was totally a freak accident, you're going to die, and there's nothing you can do about it, and in between, life is horrible. And so here we have this, you're born, it's a freak accident, you're going to die, that's pretty horrible as it is, and life as it is pretty horrible, and what are we going to do to make, you know, to while away the time that we have in this miserable thing we call existence? And that is the background of I would say, that's the 99% background that we're all born into. Everybody has that deep in their gut. And the spiritual tradition, recognizing that, and it's called different names by different spiritual traditions. Christians call it original sin. And the original sin is that feeling that you have. The spiritual traditions try to emulate or emoliate those feelings. They try to transform them so that you don't have such a hopeless view of yourself and existence. And in order to do so, one has to give up notions that the material world is the only thing of relevance. And in doing that, there's something else which has to be given up. And that thing is probably the hardest thing to give up. That's your ego. Your ego is the surface of protection which governs the functioning of your body-mind. And your body-mind has only one basic goal, keep you surviving as long as it can. The body-mind is its predicate, I'm going to die, but I'm going to do everything I can to keep this guy going. So eat well, take care of yourself, do this, that sort of thing. If somebody attacks you, kill them. You know, I mean, these are the basic elements that that have allowed us to evolve over maybe a million or more years to the present state that we're in. So the spirit tradition tries to remove that from one's consideration. And when one does that, we get into what is called the ancient spiritual teachings. Now, the Indians, 5,000 more or so years ago, and certainly at the time of Buddha and before that, the time of Patanjali and other Indian teachers, began to recognize that or saw that this way of dealing with the world led to nothing but pain and suffering. And there must be another way, and if one discovers another way, then one can get out of this normal kind of pain and suffering that we all seem to feel. And the story of Krishna and Arjuna is just such a story. In this case, Arjuna, the king, has got to go to battle and fight and kill even people that he formerly loved or were formerly family members of his, and this is a pretty hard thing for him to want to do. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really want to do that. But he has to anyway, and so he tries to find solace by going out into the field of battle and talks to his charioteer driver, the one who drives his chariot into the war the next morning, and his name is Krishna. And it turns out this is not just a chariot driver named Krishna, it's the Lord God Krishna, the Lord God who of all time, who then says, look, let me show you who I really am. And so doing, Arjuna sees that Krishna is all faces of all beings through all time, including the face of Arjuna, the king himself. And in so seeing that, he begins to see that the act we have of being and the sense of being in a person is only a very small part of the whole spectrum of life, and that one learns through Krishna to identify with the whole spectrum of life, not just with the individual you happen to be at the moment. And that essentially fits into modern science in a very interesting way, because right now what we've seen in modern science is some mysteries that are still eluding us. What is the principle out of which the universe came into being? What are we made of? How is it that observation has an effect on the things that we think we're made of, or the things the universe seems to be made of? Is there such an effect? What's going on there? So these kinds of questions bring in the notion of mind into matter, and that's where my work really gets started.
You're listening to Beyond Reality. I'm talking to Dr. Fred Alan Wolfe. You can visit him online at www.fredalanwolfe.com, and you can see Dr. Wolf and I this weekend in Santa Fe at the International Conference on Science and Consciousness. Now, here's something interesting that happened in India that brings up some kind of interesting philosophical discussion.
Mm-hmm.
We were in Delhi at a conference, and we went to these special astrologers called Nadi Leaf Readers, and I don't know if you've ever heard of this.
I've heard of it. I haven't really gotten into the things that they supposedly are able to do. I mean, I understand they're pretty amazing.
This friend of mine told me about it. So we went to this office where they took our thumbprint, okay, and then they went up into the office and they searched through these records. And then when they came down, they told us that there were about five of us who had our leaves there that were supposedly written 3,000 years ago, and that we were supposedly destined to show up. They told me I would be there before my 39th birthday to pick this thing up, and they started telling me things about myself. I mean, I'm talking about all they had was my fingerprint. And so when we went back to the conference, there was a couple hundred people there, and we kind of got in this discussion about, you know, oh, my God, I mean, what does this say about, you know, free will, and, you know, I'm kind of, after reading your book and others, I'm into the philosophy that we're creating new universes by our choices, and that maybe we're in control of this whole thing we call life. And so how is it possible then? Was I really destined to do certain things? And so how does destiny, in your opinion, kind of blend in and work with the idea of parallel universes and choice and free will and things like that?
Well, I don't really know how these guys, I mean, for one thing, I'm just curious about what these guys were doing. I don't really know how or if they were really able to do what apparently they were able to do. I mean, how does one know that they're not just faking it? I mean, unless you can read Sanskrit, I mean, how do you?
I don't know. I mean,
so you have to trust them that they're not deceiving you. But you know, there are a lot of fakirs out there, fakers out there, and you don't really know whether you should believe these guys or not. But the larger question, the question that you're bringing up here, the question of destiny, is a very interesting one, and it's been a constant part. I would think maybe one of the major themes of philosophy is: are we destined? That is there no way that we can escape or change the course of our own personal histories? Is this all the way it's supposed to be, or is there just a tremendous amount of free will going on, and that people really do can alter and change what's happening to them? That's a difficult question to resolve, and there doesn't seem to be any clear answer, even from science. There doesn't seem to be any answer which says it's got to be one way or the other. What seems to emerge at all is that there seems to be a destiny which governs the possibilities or the field of possibility which exists, which must be primal and must exist before there's anything actual. And that field of possibility is destined. That is, it has a cause and effect or causal or determined relationship of how it is now to how it's going to be in the future and how it was in the past. But there are disruptions which can intercept that, which happens when individuals make observations of their life or of nature. And when these observations take place, there are momentary disruptions of that field, but the field recovers from
right.
the disruption. And there's a kind of inertia to itself. So there's a kind of, in that sense, if I would say that the Akashic records or the so-called mystical records of which everything is written down, as these people in India might have told you, is really the field of possibility. It doesn't really cover the actual thing. In other words, you may not never go to India, and
right.
the possibility of you being there may be written down, but not the actuality. And only when you arrive there are they able to, in some way, read through and find a trace of your position being there with hindsight. More or less like this code of the Bible that was discovered. Remember, if one writes the Bible in a certain way, a matrix of letters in a certain way,
right.
one can find strings along diagonals and whatever of the names of events or situations that will happen or names of people throughout all of history. And of course, one can, with hindsight. Hindsight's great. You can look back and say, yes, that's exactly what happened. But can you do it with foresight? And the answer seems to be no. We can't seem to be able to do that with foresight. So, again, the hindsight shows us things are determined. Foresight says they're not.
I didn't know what it was, you know, but it was very interesting.
Yes, it is.
Put it that way. And I, like I said, what I enjoyed most was it kind of brought up the whole discussion about what we're destined to do or not. But that gets into a lot of what your book on parallel universes was originally about, that there's a field of possibilities out there, and only if we go experience one or observe one, then that possibility becomes enlivened, right? I mean,
right.
So therefore, it's more likely to maybe happen or not happen, and the other ones are just sitting there.
Yes.
Unobserved
yes.
and maybe
yeah.
dormant or something? Is that how
well,
would...
yeah, observation affects everything. It changes everything. But as I say, from what I understand of quantum physics, things recover after they're observed, after you observe where things are. The next instant of time, and it's very short, things begin to blur out again into what is called the field of possibility, which itself has a kind of a shape, but it's in many, many dimensions, and it's hard to visualize. So that's where quantum physics comes in. It's a physics of a space of an infinite number of dimensions, and that may seem very bizarre, but that's basically what we physicists deal with when we make calculations. It's not as hard to actually do a calculation or figure something out from it, but it sounds strange when you talk about it.
Yeah, I guess it is, but that's part of the fun.
Yeah, that's part of the fun.
Now, what do you think about the work that's being done on the quantum computer right now?
Well, that's a very interesting field. I don't know how much you've read or looked into it. I think it's a very important new field that has been discovered, and it's been going on now. It's been since its inception as a possibility. It's been about 20 years now. I think around 1985, 86 is when the first few inklings of the notion of quantum computation first began to appear. All of their earlier writings by some physicists back in the 70s, but the first real attempt to think about the problem of computation and how computers work from the point of view of quantum physics really began there. It's now 20 years later, and we haven't gotten very far. We've gotten reasonably far, but it's the problem of getting one of actually building one of any size like that which has the robustness and stability that our present computers do seems to be a problem. If you try to remember back when computers first began to appear, one of the big problems they had was they kept going down, suddenly your data would disappear. And this is part of the instability with just a regular computer, just normal little glitches which crop up because you're working with a lot of data in a very hot background, and that heat and can cause little glitches in the memory units in a computer, and these glitches eventually then keep the lead to the non-operation of the computer. Well, nowadays modern laptops and so forth are pretty stable. I mean, it's very rare that I've ever had a thing just shut down on me where I've had to really just reboot. Whereas 10 years ago, rebooting was like almost every other day you had to reboot because something was going wrong. Well, right now we're very far. We're not even close to that field, to that area of dealing with life with quantum computer. Hardly beyond the first few little memory units, and it's going to take a lot more development. But if we can find a stable way of holding on to what are called qubits, which are the quantum bits of information, which are different from bits, which are the zeros and ones of the normal computer, we are going to have an intelligence impressed in a mechanical device that will surpass anything we've ever seen in any device at all. Quantum computers will be smarter and even more, definitely have more intelligence at their fingertips than we will. And they will surpass human brains because they may not surpass human brains in all things that humans do, but they certainly will when it comes to data processing.
Why do we want
thinking.
That?
What?
Why do we want that? Do we want that?
I don't know if we want that or if there's a want for it. It's very hard to know. We are curious animals, and we will keep exploring just for the fun of discovering. And I think there is something in us that makes us want to know and want to understand. There's a lot of mystery out there, and we want to keep exploring. And when we go deeper into the mystery, more mystery gets revealed to us rather than less. So we don't really come to an end of the road. We just find that the road is a lot bigger than we thought it was. And I think that's the nature of being a human being. I mean, after all, there are everything is born and everything dies in the physical plane. There's nothing which escapes that in the physical world.
Right.
Everything gets born, everything dies in the physical world. It doesn't matter what it is. There's nothing that stays forever. And lifetimes of things. I mean, even mountains crumble and appear. So there's nothing which escapes that. Our own planet Earth is going to be gone in about, 6 to 7 billion years. It's not going to be around. And a billion years may seem like an awful long time, but it is not really that big of a thing. I mean, it's not that long of a time. It's long for a lifetime for a human being, but not on a cosmic scale. It's not.
Right.
So it's a small. The sun is going to burn out in about that time. It's going to go into a red giant phase, and that's when the sun will grow so giantly and grandly and big and big that its outer limbs will encompass the orbit of the Earth, and our Earth won't be able to withstand that, so it's going to die. So if we, whatever that means by the time in 6-7 billion years from now, if we are going to survive, we're probably not going to survive in this form that we have right now. So what that form is going to be, I don't know. And if I can jump in imagination, imagine that maybe a million or so years ago, we were having the same conversation, but we were amoebas.
We're evolving. We've evolved.
We've evolved, yeah. And we don't know what the next evolution is going to be.
Gosh, that's so funny because, I know people who sit around, did you know that the sun is going to burn out our planet? And I'm thinking, you know, you are not going to be here at that time, I don't think.
Yeah.
So nothing to worry about.
Well, it's nothing to worry about. It's just that if you're looking for what's driving us to investigate and solve and look into the mysteries, that's going to be the answer right there.
Right. You bring up another interesting point. I think that part of being human is the fact that we're sitting around here going, you know, what's the meaning of life? Why am I here? And when we're asking those kinds of questions, then that's when we begin to look into things. And I agree with what you're saying, but how are we ever going to uncover the answer? I don't really think that we can, because every time we learn something, we realize that we really don't know anything, because the mysteries are just popping up in greater numbers.
Well, that's true, but we wouldn't even have had the understanding to see the mystery if we hadn't explored and found an answer. So it's not that it's a fruitless venture that we're on. We're gathering great fruits as we go.
Right.
But we're also finding that there are new things that we can understand and learn as we go.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Now, I want to talk about wormholes. Mm-hmm. The whole thing where people are talking about, you know, wormholes or gateways into other worlds.
Right.
So is that true? I mean, in your opinion, obviously. Or is that science fiction? What do you think?
It's not. Well, first of all,
Let's say, is it possible?
Is it possible? Yes, it is possible. It's definitely possible. Scientists, particularly physicists, have been taking it very seriously for a number of years now. People are beginning to write about the stability of black holes and what they are. And there's really two kinds of let's call them items, which could exist that are under the label a black hole. First of all, let me tell you a little bit about what a black hole is. The very first person to realize that there were some very bizarre consequences that could arise when a heavy star imploded on itself. His name was Carl Schwarzschild. The reason I bring up his name is because Schwarzschild means black shield. So it's funny that he would discover the black hole, the question of the shield surrounding the black hole was also of great interest. The so-called horizon of a black hole is of great interest. So that's a funny thing that the guy that discovered it, his name was Schwarzschild. He did that back in 1916. And what was happening around that time is that Einstein had just generated by that time a series of what are called field equations. Einstein's dream at that time was to try to understand gravity and space and time together, and even infold into that mixture our understanding of the forces of nature which arise and whether everything can be explained as one unified field. That was his dream. And that's where why general relativity became very difficult, because each of these force fields that we deal with in nature are different on different scales. That is, some are more long range, like gravity, and some are very short range, like the nuclear fields which hold the nucleons together inside the nucleus, and the electromagnetic field, which is kind of in between those two. So these are these different fields of force, and they have different ranges of application. Because the mathematics dealing with them is different, the idea of unifying those to one way, to one field, was very difficult to do. So that's where Einstein started. And by 1916, at least the gravity and space-time part had been solved and it generated what it called the Einstein field equations of general relativity. And what was interesting was that when you solved these equations, there were solutions you could find. And one of the cases was special case of when gravity was so strong because a star was massive enough that its gravitational field overcame the natural tendency to push the boundaries of the star apart, which comes about through radiation pressure, which is pushing everything apart as a result of the nuclear explosions which are going on in the interior of the star, which generate the radiant energy. The gravitational field was so strong that that it was possible for the star to collapse to what appeared to be a point, a single point of huge mass. And this point would then distort. It was so big and massive. It was so massive that it would distort the space and time in its neighborhood, and it would produce what is called now a black hole, a place where space and time and matter just kind of disappear. It's called a singularity. We don't, you know, everybody wonder, well, what's going on? I mean, if you go near a black hole, you're just sucked up and you're gone, and that's it. And that seemed to be very, very bizarre. And later on, people began to study the nature of the structure of black holes, and they found that there was a structure to them, and that structure, that is, you can look inside of a black hole, and you can actually look around the immediate neighborhood of the point that everything collapsed to. And you would find that even there was some bizarre things going on. And what people find was that a black hole turned out to be a doorway into another universe. And this is physics. I mean, it sounds like science fiction, I know, but it's straight physics. And
good
this
stuff.
Is where the notion called of the doorway, this was called a wormhole, just like a wormhole in the ground. You go into the entrance of the wormhole, and you dig under the ground, and then you come out the exit of the wormhole. If somebody were looking at only the exit, they would think that somehow that hole is generating worms. Or if somebody were only looking at the entrance, they somehow would think that somehow that something is eating the worms and they're being dissolved or something like that. You see what I'm talking about?
Right.
The wormhole and the exit and the entrance would be separated. Well, a similar thing happens for these wormholes. It's possible that you can build a wormhole, and it turns out we now understand how one goes about building it, but we need something we don't have yet in the universe that we at least can stabilize and get control of to build one. But if we could get hold of this, what is called exotic matter, we could probably build one. But instead, it would be possible that one end of them could be, say, in Times Square, and the other end could be, say, in Tom and Rosset in the middle of the Sahara Desert, which is maybe a town there. It may take 12 to 15 hours to fly from Manhattan to Tom and Rosset, but if you had a black hole, you would simply enter the black hole and the wormhole, and take a few steps, and when you walked out, you'd be in the middle of the Sahara Desert.
Wow. That would
so
put the airlines out of business.
It would be very, very strange, but such things like that are perfectly feasible. In fact, it's now even considered possible that you could take one end of the wormhole and move it off on a rocket ship near the speed of light and then bring it back to the Earth, and it would be in the future. It would arrive on the Earth in the future, although the person that traveled with the wormhole could maybe only be gone a couple of hours. He may find himself 10 years in the future. Now, that we know about from relativity theory, but what's interesting is that if you had the wormhole, you could actually go back in the wormhole and go backwards in time to where you first left.
Wow.
So these are what makes, I think, physics fun, and
it is.
That's why I study it.
Very, very interesting. you know, they're getting closer, I guess, to fulfilling Einstein's dream, I think, of putting everything into one equation. Do you think that's going to happen in our lifetime?
It probably won't. I don't know about our lifetime. My lifetime may not be the same as yours. But,
well,
but given the generic hour being, let's say, the next 50 years or so, I don't think it's going to happen. If we don't change a certain way of looking at the world, the basic understanding, the basic tool that we've been using up to now has been one of taking something apart to understand its structure. And that's it. In other words,
right,
whatever we're doing, we take apart to understand. And there's something about quantum physics which has told us that there's a limit to that. After a certain point, you don't get anything new by taking it apart. In fact, what emerges is just another putting back together. In other words, you take something apart, and paradoxically, you're putting something else back together. And that's called the principle of complementarity in quantum physics. And a very bizarre thing, but that's what we've discovered. It's led to it shows up in many different ways, but without going into that detail. So what seems to be evident is that what we might be missing is the effect of an observer on all the stuff that we're talking about. And it may be the limit that we've reached is one of how far we can go without talking about the subjective element of physics. And I don't think we can go any deeper without bringing in the subjective element of physics. Now, how we're going to go about doing that, I don't know. Nobody knows. People are still attempting to solve the structure problem. Can we bring gravity and electromagnetism and the nuclear forces and so on and so forth and space and time? Can we and quantum physics? Can we get those all together under one felt swoop, under one roof of understanding, one theory of everything called a TOE or TOE? Can we build a TOE? And the answer that people hope for is that we can, but the current understanding is that in so doing, we've now reached into a realm of thinking that no experiment is ever going to confirm. And because of the lack of any experimental confirmation of the realm of thinking we're currently using, some physicists have tossed up their hands and said, that's it. This isn't physics anymore. It's now metaphysics. And that may be the direction we have to go in.
Yeah, as the world's shifting into, you know, the bridging of the gap between spirituality and science.
Right.
That maybe, I guess, that would be possible, but then some people would never believe it was real because they couldn't prove it.
Well, there is in science today, at the very core of the most robust and strictest science of all, quantum physics, the very core of it is unprovable statements. So we're already faced with that. And, it'll be foolish, and I don't think any physicist who really understands quantum physics would ever deny that. Many people who don't know enough about the deeper parts would tend to maybe think that that at the core of the most strictest science in the world would be more solid evidence, and the answer is no. There's solid, very solid speculation, theoretical, but nothing which could ever be demonstrated in a completely experimental way. So that the understanding of what that core of the reality is would be subject to a tremendous amount of explanation and hand-waving and different viewpoints, and these different viewpoints would be different interpretations of what it all meant, and there are a lot of those.
Yeah. You're listening to Beyond Reality, and I'm talking to Dr. Fred Alan Wolf. Visit him online at fredalanwolf.com. Back to the quantum computer thing again a little bit. I mean, is it really necessary for us to build these machines? I mean, I think I've read in your books yourself that you think that the real time machine is actually between our ears.
Well, the notion, yes, I think that the nature of time travel and the actual carrying out of experiments in time travel will begin through a better understanding of mind and neurophysiology, that we're actually going to be doing it that way if we're going to be doing it at all, because the energetics or the energy requirements needed to make a physical device are so overwhelming, technologically speaking, that it seems doubtful to me that we're ever going to seriously look at that as a way of time traveling. It just requires too much energy. Or what I explained to you about making a black hole turn into a wormhole that was stable enough to hold open two ends so that you can travel through it. You would need something called exotic matter, which would act repulsively inside of the wormhole, keeping the walls from collapsing on itself. And it's hard to talk about that. I'm speaking metaphorically when I say that, but that's basically the idea that space-time is like a distorted wall around a black hole and around a wormhole. And it quickly closes off if there's nothing in it to keep it from happening. And the only thing that seems to be able to keep it from happening would be some form of exotic matter. And physicists at Caltech, just in the last 10 years or so, have published papers on that. And there's books about it. One famous physicist at Caltech, Kip Thorne, is well known for his theories on using wormholes as time machines. But I think it's going to come through the mind, and that's going to involve some kind, as I understand it, it's going to involve some way of releasing what we call the individual ego. As the ego releases, as we begin to be less concerned about body, mind, and survival, the window of time that we normally call the now, will greatly broaden for us. And future, past, and present will start to be witnessed. It'll be kind of like looking at a number of photographs superposed on each other. That's maybe how it's first going to start. And people that start having these experiences will think to themselves, or maybe having double vision or multiple thoughts going on. It may be very difficult to cipher or to decide or to even think about what's happening to one is having this kind of time travel experience. It's not going to be an easy field, because time and the ego are very, very much connected together.
Yeah, the ego. Difficult. The kind of work, I'm a hypnotherapist, and sometimes people come in because they're stuck, and I take them through guided journeys where I take them out and I have them imagine that they're going into the future so that they can see themselves creating a positive situation for themselves and a life that they really want to live and all that kind of stuff. And I was out doing a talk one night, and there was a really brilliant physicist in the front row who told me that he had devised a formula for now, the mathematical calculation of now, and it was some big number, which, you would understand. I didn't understand it. And in the book, The Yoga of Time Travel, you talk a lot about measuring time and whether or not that's even possible. And I was wondering if you could just talk about time a little bit and why time goes forward and all that kind of stuff.
Well, first of all, the idea that time goes forward is really not true. It's difficult to talk about it because time itself can't move. Because if time were to move, then it would have to move in time to move. So how do I move 1 second to the next second? It doesn't. Time, in a sense, is frozen. It's a frozen block. We move through time. I mean this in the same sense that asking how does time move or how does time flow would be like asking if you go outside and look at the street that you're presently on, and look at the sidewalk, and you see the sidewalk stretches from one corner of one block to the next corner on the next block, asking how does timer would be asking like how does that stretch of sidewalk move? Well, you'd say, well, it moves because the whole Earth is rotating. Yes, but then you say everything is moving in time. But how does it move relative to itself? Well, it doesn't move relative to self. It's relative to itself. It's a street. It's a length of it's a length of line, and that length of line is the same length of line. It doesn't change. So time really doesn't flow. It's like a length of line. It's just we can scan from one end to the other end of the street, and we can scan from the beginning of time to the end of time, just like we do down the street. And that's one vision of time, called a linear view of time. Each view we take of time, for example, in this case, the linear view, gives us a picture, and then we begin to tie together our human experiences with that picture. And if we can make sense or have an experience of making sense of that picture, then we use it. And we say that that's okay for us, and that's what time is. So we think now, because of our current schedule of life and things that we do, and the fact that we all want to make sure our airplanes leave on the right time, and we want to make sure that we celebrate our birthdays at the right date and so forth, we have a, what's called a linear view of time, and it serves our world very well. There are other views of time, though, and when you look at those other views, you realize that that any view of time that we have is conditioned by the utility of that view. And in other cultures, in, say, Aboriginal Australian culture, there are two views of time that are current. One is our view, the linear time, but there's also another time which has different names. It's called El Chiringa is the original name in the Australian language, as I understand it. And that's been translated by two anthropologists in the beginning of the 20th century when first went to Australia from England, named Gillan and Spencer, and they called it dream time. And that was made famous in a movie called The Last Wave that a guy named Weir, I can't remember his first name, from made his first big movie and then became Hollywood after that, talked about that concept of the dream time. And it's very real to Australian Aboriginal people. They don't see time as frozen in that sense, but they see it as a the best I can say, or the best I can draw a picture of, is they see it as like a hoop rolling, and the sacred is constantly entering, like a hoop rolling along a line. The hoop of sacred time rolls along the line of line time, linear time, and where it touches, there's a spark of the spiritual which keeps entering. So that's my metaphor for it, but I don't know how they would see it. But they see the ancestors and the present time and not being far back but ever present now, so the great spirits are still here now. They don't see them as back there then, whereas we might say that in some culture we might say that the great spirit made us 1,000 years ago, but it's not here now. Or God was here maybe when Moses was around, but he ain't around now. But he may be looking down on us, but he ain't here. You know, we have this notion that he's back there then. That's when that God existed. In the ancient spiritual traditions of the Australian Aboriginal, that isn't the way they look at it. God is ever present, can't, in a way, can't even get out of it.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting way to look at life, but here we're just already kind of conditioned to the Western. So,
yeah,
and that's why the therapy that I do, it works, but I think that if people would start tuning in more to a hoop-like reality, then they could, I don't know, I think you have a chance to really have more, I don't want to say control, but more opportunities to really make an interesting life for yourself by tapping into things from the past and bringing that forward. And
maybe,
yeah. So, unfortunately, we're almost out of time. You're listening to Beyond Reality. I'm talking to Dr. Fred Allen Wolf. Visit Dr. Wolf online at fredallenwolf.com. And this weekend out in Santa Fe, New Mexico, Dr. Wolf and I will be speaking at the International Conference on Science and Consciousness. Dr. Wolf, thank you so much
for being on
the show. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in a few days.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Beyond Reality. I'm Dr. Shelley Kerr. Visit my website at www.galactichealing.org, or you can visit the radio show site at beyondrealityshow.com. Until next time, have a beautiful day. Namaste.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program. And we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.